Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner reminding you to join us Thursday night, the 12th at 7:30 at Red Emma's for a screening and discussion of the movie Food Chains as we look at the Immokalee workers and farmer workers' rights and the future of food. We'll have a discussion that I'll be leading there. It's sponsored by the Center for a Livable Futures Baltimore Food and Faith Project. Please go to redemmas.org for more information, but please join us there for a live taping, which we'll be playing on our program in the next week. So we are now joined by Dr. Stephen David, who is Professor of Political Science and Vice Dean for Undergraduate Education at Johns Hopkins University. Phyllis Bennis is Director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies as we look at the latest news in the Middle East and ISIS. And Phyllis and Stephen, welcome back. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks, great to be here.
Nice to be here. Except I'm no longer a dean. I'm a full-time professor again.
No longer a dean. Good for you.
Feels good.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. All right, email us at talk@steinershow.org or tweet us at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So, you know, when I look at this crisis, and I was on a program the other day where I posited, let me start with you, Phyllis Bennis. I posited that do we have common ground to say that part of what we're looking at here is American foreign policy in Iraq, Afghanistan, in Libya, not just American but West in general, but American specifically, then in some ways engendered part of what we're looking at now. So before we talk about what our next policy step should be, we should think about where we came from and how we got here.
Absolutely. I would say that it's a lot more than half. The very specific origins of ISIS are with the U.S. occupation of Iraq. ISIS has, as I think most of your listeners know, changed its name a number of times. It was the Islamic State in Iraq. Before that, it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq or Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. It's morphed into various iterations. But the origins were as one of many militias that rose up to fight against the U.S. occupation and the government and military that the U.S. put in power. That government became so sectarian, so Shia-dominated and anti-Sunni in its practice, meaning not just privileging Shia for jobs or things like that, but real repression, mass arrests, the torture in prison, bombings of Sunni communities. It was horrifying, and it's one of the reasons, one of the big reasons, why a very small organization like ISIS has had the power that it has to take over these huge swaths of territory in both Iraq and and Syria, including large cities. They now have somewhere between 5 and 6 million people under their rule. And part of the reason is that many in these Sunni communities were so desperate under this sectarian Shia-dominated government that the U.S. had put in power and was arming and paying, that they turned to an organization as extremist and violent as ISIS is, and said, we might hate these guys, but somehow they're better than what we've had up until now. And that's why this claim that we hear all the time that we need to change the hearts and minds of the Sunni communities while we commit these military actions is simply never going to work. Because while we hear, if the U.S. bombs, or these days Jordan bombs, some community in Fallujah or Raqqa, these cities that have now been taken over by ISIS, we here in the U.S. hear from our government and from the press and lots of other people saying, yay, we got the bad guys. And what people there see is, the U.S. is bombing in defense of the Shia and the Kurds against the Sunnis. And so we better stick with ISIS. So these bombing raids are undermining everything that the Obama administration says it wants to do in response. And it's very much rooted in the U.S. policy of having invaded and occupied Iraq in the first place.
Stephen?
Well, I agree with some of that, not all of it. I think indirectly, America's intervention created the conditions by which ISIS emerged and became so powerful. But let's not forget that Iraq under Saddam Hussein was no picnic either. And more to the point, I mean, the principal responsibility for what ISIS is doing lies on the feet of ISIS. It's those individuals who are committing these barbaric acts that deserve most of our wrath. And I'd go on to say that, bombing isn't a cure-all. It seems to me the only way, or one of the only ways of getting rid of ISIS is through military operations, not American boots on the ground. but the United States helping those who are most threatened, the Kurds, the Shia in Iraq, as well as the moderate Sunnis. The notion that somehow without military support, somehow ISIS is going to disappear is something I can't accept.
But that is, this is where I think the discussion is heating up in Washington and other places, is what should then our response be to all of this? I mean, and how do you create a response? I was thinking about how, you know, we've gone into Libya, we tore Libya apart, and many people put part of the root of Boko Haram's being able to grow is because of a destroyed Libya that pushed things south. You see what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. So what should be the response? Turkey clearly has the biggest army in the region. They're not coming in. So, Phyllis Menas, how do you – my guess is you don't think it should be a military response. I'm
right.
curious what you think it should be, and I want to go back to David.
I mean, it's a critical question, and I think we have to recognize that there's not always going to be an immediate response that works right now. The bombing certainly hasn't worked right now, but there's the illusion that it's urgent and therefore – and it is urgent. For people there, it is horrifying living under these regimes, this ISIS regime. But let's not forget, a year ago, we were hearing the same thing about how urgent it was to use military force against the regime in Damascus, because it was the worst in the world. The people there were suffering under that regime more than anybody could imagine anywhere else, and so we had to use military force. Now, are we going to face a year from now that there's some other organization that's even worse than ISIS that emerges, and suddenly ISIS is going to be a de facto ally, the way the Assad regime is now a de facto ally of the United States in going after ISIS? This notion that it can be a military solution, we've seen it over and over again. It just doesn't work. So we start with, number one, do no harm. Stop bombing. Stop the military. Then we need serious new negotiations. That doesn't mean that you're going to sit down with al-Baghdadi. You know, this is always the answer. Well, how can you negotiate with people like that? Well, people like that are probably not going to come to the negotiating table anyway, so that's not the point. But they are not functioning in a vacuum. They are not functioning alone. They have support, and this is one of the tragic parts that is reflective of the government in Iraq and its sectarianism. They have support from some of the Sunni tribal leaders. They have support from a number of former Iraqi generals who were summarily thrown out of the military when the U.S. destroyed the military after it invaded in 2003 and have been looking for a way to get revenge, and they found it with ISIS. So, you know, we can't pretend that this is just ISIS, these nut jobs on their own. They have support that we have to acknowledge. So we have to have negotiations with those who are making what they do possible. That means we have to look at the war in Syria overall. We have to look at what's it going to take to stop that now six-part or seven-part civil war in Syria. That means new negotiations involving Russia, involving Iran. We've got to build on what the UN has started with small-scale ceasefires in Syria, starting at the local level and building to the regional and eventually national. We've got to then begin talks on a national ceasefire and an arms embargo on all sides. That means there's got to be pressure on Iran and Russia to stop arming the Assad regime, and the only way that can happen is if the U.S. puts enough pressure on its allies to stop arming, as the Saudis have been doing, arming ISIS and others, but also arming all of the other opposition forces that are keeping this civil war going in Syria. And finally, we have to be putting massively more, bigger, huger amounts of money into refugee and humanitarian assistance throughout the region, which is an absolute humanitarian disaster right now. So there's a ton of things that need to happen. And as long as the focus is on the military, we keep hearing, oh, yeah, and we should also do X, Y, and Z. But we never do them as long as the energy and the focus and the priority is going to the military.
Stephen, I'm going to open the phones right after this.
I disagree with much of what Phyllis said. I mean, there's a military threat that's ongoing right now through ISIS. ISIS is very well armed. It's very well funded. As Phyllis suggested, it's taken over wide swaths of territory, controlling lots of people whose lives are hell now. We have allies in the area who want to fight, who are able to fight. The Kurds, the Shia in Iraq, moderate Sunnis. What they need, especially in terms of the Kurds, are weapons to deal with the kinds of threats they're facing. It's all well and good to talk about negotiations and we're going to get Syria to stop this and we're going to get Iran and Russia to agree with us. But that hasn't happened in the past, and I see no reason
for it.
Excuse me, I let you speak. I see no reason for it to happen in the near future. We have to provide an incentive for those on the ground to negotiate, and part of that incentive is to convince them that they cannot succeed militarily. In order to prevent them from succeeding militarily, we have to give our allies the means by which they can defend themselves. They're not calling for American troops. We're not talking about a 2003 Iraqi invasion. We're talking about giving the Peshmerga and other groups the armored cars, the anti-tank weapons, the weapons that ISIS has, and to enable them to protect themselves, to regain the land, to regain the people who are living lives of living hell under ISIS control. And the notion that we should simply stop these arms and allow ISIS to go unfettered throughout this territory in the hopes that somehow we're going to convince Iran and Russia to cooperate when they've never done so in the past, strikes me as a fantasy.
Let me be in our friends. A lot of people have called in. Let's try to get a couple calls in here that both, you both can respond to. 410-319-8888. Sal in Fells Point, you're on the air.
Hello, Mark. I appreciate the time.
Welcome.
I just wanted to ask, you know, when Obama asked for congressional approval, what was he specifically asking for? From my perspective, I think he's asking for boots on the ground. And not only is he asking for boots on the ground, he's asking to, I know they agreed to give Israel another $100 million for the Iron Dome system, and that Israel actually hit a missile defense system that was Russia was delivering to Syria. And it just so happens that all this ISIS stuff started happening after John McCain visited the region and funded these Syrian anti-Assad rebels that used chemical weapons that were provided by the U.S. So I just want to get the Republicans' thought on all this arming of these groups, and then at the end of the day, we just have people killing each other. And it only seems like Israel is benefiting from all this destabilization.
Okay, Sal, thank you. Stephen, I think I was talking to you, Stephen, though Stephen is not a Republican. Go ahead, Stephen.
I couldn't catch the whole question. I'm sorry.
The whole question, I guess, in essence, was that a lot of this funding now is the $100 million going to Israel to build to help with the shield, the dome, to kill up missiles that they've intercepted. The similar stuff coming into Syria by Russia. That all this is benefiting Israel more than anybody else, and in terms of the weak response to ISIS.
Well, I guess this is an example of what we have to bring in Israel no matter what happens, and we have to blame the Israelis for what's going on in the Middle East. I think ISIS is an example where Israel is very much on the margins. What Israel has done or has not done has not been central to the story of ISIS. I'm sure if one wants to push this, you can find some connections. But you can certainly make the case that the Syrian civil war and the disorder in the Middle East has gone to Israel's detriment. I mean, the Israeli border with Syria on the Golan Heights was very quiet during both Assad's reign. Now that there's instability and civil conflict and ISIS running around, Israel has had problems on that border. So to make the case that somehow this goes to Israel's benefit or that Israel is somehow responsible for this, I don't see the logic in that.
Phyllis Penis?
What is important is that the Israeli alliance, as it were, with the Syrian leadership goes on for a long time. As we just heard, the Syrian regime under Assad kept the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights quiet, prevented there from being a real uprising against Israeli occupation there. So that's certainly true, and it is threatened now. But I think what's more important, when the caller also asked about the authorization that the Obama administration is asking for, which is not only about money, but it's about real authorization for war. And the authorization that the administration is requesting is one which would have no limits. there are a number of Democrats in Congress that are talking about a new authorization, which in my view is a terrible idea because we've seen how these authorizations get used over the years. The one from 2001 and 2002, those two, which were very specific, everyone thought, have been used with no specificity, have been used to go to war anywhere in the world against whoever we want, with whatever weapons we want for as long as we want, with no limits at all. And what the Obama administration now says they want is another authorization that will not have any limits. The limits that are being talked about are very mild limits. They're hardly limits at all. They say no ground troops and maybe geographic limits would only involve Iraq and Syria. And the administration says, no, we don't want even those limits because who knows what will happen in the future. And what we already see, we can say no ground troops, but there are already ground troops back in Iraq. 3,100 have already been approved. That's thousands of ground troops. You know, we don't like to admit that this, you know, that this war is now also involving U.S. ground troops, as well as the return of U.S. bombers to the air over Iraq, U.S. bombers in Syria, with all of the inevitable civilian casualties that are the consequence of that.
Let me get a very quick call in here and have some closing thoughts at 410-319-8888. Alan, you're on the air. Very quickly.
Ain't nobody here but us chickens.
Alan, we don't have much time, man.
Okay, hey. Okay, I find that neither one of you is talking about an anti-war movement, building an anti-war movement. And even more, I find that Phyllis Bennett, in her past, I've heard her talk about appealing to the American middle class about... If the money wasn't spent on the war, it could be spent on benefits for Americans, which I find to be highly national chauvinistic. Basically, what it boils down to is if we could fight the war cheaper, that would be okay. And I approached her with that, and she said in a very rude manner she had never heard about it. But that's the logic that I come to and a lot of other...
Okay, well, we only have about a couple minutes left, and I do want to let Phyllis respond to that and let them have some closing thoughts.
I think
Phyllis.
Building an anti-war movement is crucial. We should be against these wars for moral reasons, for economic reasons. There's a host of reasons to be opposed to these wars, and the most important of which is they are damaging, they are killing people in Iraq and Syria. They're not making lives better there. It's also true that the war budget that takes 58 cents out of every dollar of our taxes distorts the U.S. economy so badly that things for poor people in this country, whether it's education, jobs, health care, we always hear there's no money, and the reason that there's not enough money in those budgets is because the budget is weighted too much on the side of the military.
And David, and Phyllis, make a quick final thought. I really appreciate this conversation.
A couple of quick final thoughts. One, we spend about 4% of our GDP for defense. During the Cold War, we typically spent about 10%. And when we talk about all the killing being done by bombing and by arming people in the region, let's not forget that under ISIS rule, children are being crucified, women are being raped. There's a reign of terror going on. There are people who are desperate for our assistance, who simply want weapons to protect themselves. For the United States to turn a blind eye to that is something that would make me to be ashamed to be an American.
And about 30 seconds left, Phyllis. I'm sorry.
I think it's very important that we not take the position that we either go to war and arm everybody or we do nothing. That's never the only choice. We have a host of other options. We need to be looking at alternatives to war, not accepting the notion that it's either go to war or let them get away with it.
Phyllis Bennett from the Institute for Policy Studies and Stephen David from Johns Hopkins University, thank you both so much for being with us. It's been really engaging and to have different thoughts on this and for our listeners to be able to wrestle all this. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And on our way to break, it's an appropriate song. I Feel the Earth Move, Carole King. She was born on this day in 1942. I'm glad she was. We'll be right back with Dee Watkins. And the next new piece he's written about literacy in his community, what it means. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The month of May. Oh, darling, I can't stay.